The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. The other day I went down to our science lab and watched our angler fish. Have you ever seen an angler fish, a fish that actually has a fishing rod sticking out of his head between his eyes with a kind of a blob on it? And they put one of these helpless little mollies, it's a type of a freshwater fish that is found in aquariums, in the tank. And this thing almost crawled toward that molly on what looked to be a combination of four arms and a kind of an ugly-looking fin, and began to huff and puff and sort of swell itself up, and then finally, when the molly got within range, in such a rapid gesture I could hardly even see how it occurred, this anglerfish swallowed that little tiny fish. Now, this is one of the unbelievable types of life that you see all about you on this earth, and yet, of course, many people aren't familiar with the anglerfish, or yet they've heard of it maybe in some of the life science series or things of this nature. But here is a fish, believe it or not, many different species of him, that has the equivalent of a fishing pole projecting out of his forehead with a kind of a little growth of tissue on the end of it that might look like a worm, which he holds tantalizingly right in front of his great, big, ugly mouth, and dangles it so a little unsuspecting fish will swim by. And the fish, the big one, the anglerfish, looks just about like a rock. And when the little fish swims by, snap, quicker than your eye can even see it, he reaches out and grabs it. Now, when I was down there watching one of our very colorful saltwater fish of the angelfish variety, swam over to a shrimp. And the shrimp sort of opened up his arms and encased this fish and began to pick him clean. And it's one of the most remarkable things you ever saw. But you know, there are 26 species of various types of fish that are called cleaner fish, and they run practically underwater barber shops in picking and cleaning and trimming up other types of life. Now, what I'm talking about is the intimate relationship between all types of living creatures. In a series of programs on The World Tomorrow, I've been talking about the interdependency and the great variety of interdependency and interrelationship, a partnership between various kinds of life forms. In this series of programs on seven proofs God exists, we've been taking a scientific view, step by step, of the almost endless variety of living creatures, of the living laws, of the around, of this material creation and this universe of ours. And we have found time and again, evolution just does not have an answer for it all. And that one brief excursion down to our science lab was just one more example of the fantastic interdependency of some of these creatures that people take for granted. Now, in the first place, the average person is hoodwinked by evolution. He assumes that the evolutionary professors and all of the various atheists and the agnostics, they're not all scientists by any means, are atheistic by any means, of course. But the average layman isn't really aware of this. He has not read very many of the admissions by the God-accepting scientists. And so he is led to assume that most of all science has totally disproved the first two chapters of Genesis. And that the statement in the beginning, God created, is anything but scientific. This is what people think. They think that science has certainly discovered the loose brick in the bottom of the foundation of this idea of religion. That certainly by now, science has caused a whole wall of religion to come tumbling down. Sort of like Humpty Dumpty. And that there is no reason to believe in a God anymore. Many, many are the quotations that I have given over this program of those who have said just that. That God is dead, who is Christ, where was Christ, what was he, and so on. That there is no God that is capable of our attention, or worthy rather of our worship or our attention today. This is what people say, and the average layman has begun somehow to believe it. And you would be amazed at the large percentages of so-called Christians who may be church-going professing Christians who actually believe in evolution. You would be amazed. Now, I've been showing you the seven great, absolutely unanswerable proofs that there is a God, and you can prove this to yourself by writing for the Plain Truth magazine and getting this article on seven proofs God exists. And the first great proof we saw, and I took several programs to go through each one of these, was there are great living laws, and those laws demand a lawgiver. And then we investigated life, and we saw the absolute law of biogenesis, that life only comes from life, and that there is such a broad, gaping chasm of separation between life and death, so insurmountable, so unfathomable by man, that life demands a life giver. And that is the second great proof, and that's divided, of course, into dozens and hundreds of minor facets, but I only had time for a part of it on this program. And then the third great proof, the fact of the creation, of the existence of matter itself, and how scientists in the various laws of thermodynamics and the ideas of the conservation of matter, and now with the experiments in radioactivity, the deterioration of matter is a scientific fact, a known fact, how uranium gradually disintegrates through many intermediate stages into lead, and how no new uranium is being created, how the earth and the very matter that is all around you was, so to speak, wound up, that it had a beginning. And so that proof I labeled creation. The fact of creation, the fact of things existing, demand, absolutely demand by any stretch of the imagination, any kind of logic, a creator. A creator is demanded for this many varicolored and interdependent and absolutely fathomless creation all around you. The very existence of things demands and requires a creator, a maker, someone who produced it. And then we investigated all that is being sustained and how you can depend upon these laws. Now, as I've said in the beginning of the series, many of these laws overlap. And yet, each one is a separate and a distinct proof of God. And every one of these continuing functions, whether it is like producing like, a horse produces a horse regardless of the different sizes and types and so on, and how there is a sustaining, upholding force. Call it a life principle, call it a force. People want to name it anything but God Almighty. But how that is another great proof that God exists, the fact of the sustaining of all things. And how your Bible says that God Almighty sustains all things by the word of His power. Now we've come in a series of programs to the fifth great proof, and that is the interdependency of everything, the great design all about you. Now, design is the major proof. Design requires a designer. You've never seen anything ugly. The closer you look in microscopic investigation of the material physical creation, the closer you look to it, the greater design you see. The closer you look at what man has made, the greater the imperfections and the flaws. The closer you look at a mineral, the closer you look at the wing of a fly or the leaf of a plant, the closer you investigate even some of the habits of these little creatures and of life forms all about you, the greater the complex design you see. Now, a major part of this fifth great proof that God Almighty does exist is the interdependency, the partnership of many of these animals and creatures, and the intimate relationship between killers and cleaners in the waters of the seas. That is such a fantastic story all by itself. Well, it's stranger than any fiction story you could ever read. Now, like all other animals, fish enter into various associations with each other and other underwater creatures. The question is, which came first? You can absolutely prove that many species cannot survive without other species. Just as you can prove that bees had to exist at the first moment that all of our flowering plants, many even of our vegetables and various other varieties of shrubs and bushes and trees and every type of flower that we know, had to be available to bees to pollinate them. Now, some of them pollinate themselves, of course, but bees are pretty strong little workers, and they pollinate a great amount of them. And the one can't exist without the other. We're just left without excuse, because the more knowledge, the more information that is disseminated, and the less excuse we have for our atheism and our denial of the existence of an all-wise creator God. Now, you can see in your investigations, if you care to look into it, a trace, a series of associations becoming more closer and more intimate right up to those in which one partner in these little creatures in the sea lives entirely at the expense of the other, and it's proved scientifically cannot live in any other way. Now, since that is true, which one of these two partners, quote, evolved, end quote, first? It's utterly impossible for them to have evolved. Now, the most obvious relationships between two living animals is that of a predator and a prey. and this begins with the smallest fishes. They eat little blobs of microscopic microorganisms, and bigger fish eat the small fish, and bigger fish eat those bigger fish, and men eat the bigger fish, and so you go. And there is a food web, a food chain. But there are many, many interrelationships between fish that I want to tell you just a few of them, because they're so fantastically interesting. There are many servicing arrangements among fish that have been established and observed beyond question. The late Conrad Limbaugh, who was a conscientious submarine biologist and photographer, a great skilled photographer, was among the very first to observe this and absolutely prove it. Fish, you see, are quite susceptible to infections and invasions of various harmful parasites and fungi. If you've got a tropical fish plant, they call it the ick, little white blobs of growth that can get on the skin of a fish. Well, if you've got one of the saltwater tanks that are quite delicate to balance and to keep just right, you don't have any problem in the sea. But when man tries to put saline water in a tank and to keep it in correct balance, he's really got a problem. He has to really be careful to keep the life forms in correct balance, and he has to somehow create a correct microscopic balance of life in the little tiny microorganisms that are in that salt water. And he doesn't even see them and doesn't know how to do it. He just has to somehow stock it with enough of the right kind of fish and in the right balance that he can keep them alive. Well, when you see these little white spots that appear to be sort of like a bruise on the body of a fish, any puncture of the skin will cause that, a small wound. It immediately becomes the focal point of bacterial infections and a sort of a furry white growth. Now, when this happens, this biologist found that you can observe these fish quite deliberately, as I saw this very colorful black and orange or black and yellow fish of ours do, swim right up into the open arms of a shrimp and allow itself to be caressed and petted and picked and swept clean. And you can find these fish quite deliberately seeking out those other fish that perform a cleaning service by nibbling the parasites and dead tissue from the wounds. The number of species which regularly clean or groom others is surprisingly large, and not only in tropical but in temperate waters as well. And they've recorded at least 26 different species that make cleaning their primary profession. Now, there are types that are called wrasses, W-R-A-S-S-E-S, of which there are about 450 varieties. And they're among the most diligent of all cleaners, and you talk about living a dangerous life. This little wrasse and the barracuda have a relationship beneficial to both, and it's they call it mutualism. They have to put a name upon it. In other words, interdependency. Mutualism, a kind of a partnership. This little tiny fish, only a tiny little thing, swims right among, in and out of, a barracuda's dagger-sharp, razor-sharp teeth, and keeps its mouth infection-free by picking away the bacterial growths and the parasites out of its mouth. A barracuda swims along lazily in between meals, and this little wrasse darts in and out of its mouth, swims along, and is picking its teeth. How about that? A mechanical toothpicker. You know, one of these days, they're making everything electrical today. You don't even go to the work anymore to take a knife and just make one little sawing motion with it. When you see some of these ads of a knife that is sawing back and forth, and you sort of hold it there, and it takes you about 30 seconds to cut a little slice of meat. You're amazed at it. You could do it in about one-tenth that time with a little bit of muscle. But at any rate, here's an automatic toothpicker in the sea. How's that for a fair exchange? The barracuda gives this little creature a tremendous area of protection. Now, you talk about protection. When you're inside a barracuda's mouth, there are not very many big fish are going to be after you. And so this little fella has a real fine partner, a great big brother, that can really look after him and protect him. But in return, he's picking this barracuda's teeth all the time. Now, there are other fish, like the pilot fish, that does duty as a diligent cleaner of manta rays. And one kind of angel fish is so well known for its grooming activities, it's actually called the barber fish along the Mexican coast. A butterfly fish, the neon goby, are also well-known cleaners. And a certain small wrasse that I talked about will actually not only go into the mouth and teeth, but work clear down into the gullet. And you know, it'll work clear down into the throat of this barracuda until he'll snap his jaws a couple of times and signify that he feels he's had enough for today, and so the little rat swims back out again. But you know, you find another kind of a fish that's a sort of a would-be customer, and it gets itself duped by a predator in cleaner's clothing. It's just like the housewife that answers the door and she thinks it's the TV repairman when actually it's a would-be attacker or a criminal of some kind. So here's this fish and it opens up its mouth for a grass cleaner to come in, and it doesn't know that it's actually a saber-toothed blenny. Now, that sounds like a strange name. But this little blenny pretends to be a wrasse. He looks just like one. And he goes through all the motions, dancing and swimming around to attract a client, just like the other wrasses do. And the minute the barracuda opens its mouth, he runs in there and starts ripping it apart with all the ferocity of a tiny barracuda. Starts biting its tongue and its mouth and everything else. Now, you know, it's fantastic what biologists have been able to uncover, the interrelationship and the interdependency of these little creatures, and how one cannot live without the other one. How would you like to hear about an undersea original minute car wash, or you might call it a fish wash, a regular cleaning station? Now, it's been found by these biologists that these bright colors and strong patterns of the tropical cleaning fishes beyond doubt serve to advertise their profession. Kind of like a barber pole, you know, hung out on a busy street. Now, they have other ways of signaling their customers as well, but when they see a prospect swimming along underwater, they swim out to meet it, and they put on a display just about like a male guppy will. A regular courtship dance. They dart around, they nudge the prospect's body, they wave their fins and tails, they nibble tantalizingly, they retreat and advance until they've really got this prospect sold on it. Now, at this point, the biologists have found, listen to this, this client, this bigger fish, appears to go into a sort of a coma. It floats motionless. It's absolutely mesmerized. It's hypnotized by this cleaner fish. And usually it will float at a peculiar angle on its side, or it'll stand on its head, or it'll even float upside down. And so the cleaner then goes to work, and it methodically begins to pick its way up and down and around the client's body, and it nibbles away these minute crustaceans and pecks away these infected spots and cleans it all up. Now, if it wants to get underneath the fin, it will just nudge gently, and then the bigger fish will lift its fin up obligingly, and the little cleaner fish will work under there and pick it all out. Then it will similarly work its way under the gill covers, and it'll probe around between the lips and teeth to persuade its client to open its mouth so it can get inside. Now, usually, the biologists have found these tropical cleaner fish have a definite place of business that becomes well-known in a sort of a permanent fish community. And at these points, you can always find a veritable congestion of customers waiting, more or less impatiently. Not, to be sure, reading a copy of Harper's Bazaar, but nevertheless swimming around and sort of agitated, waiting for their turn, to be treated for all their itches and pains. Matter of fact, this one biologist once counted 300 fish that were handled by a single cleaner fish during a six-hour period. What a way to make a living. That's a busy barber, isn't it? And he noted, now that's one a minute. You talk about the original car wash. That's really running them in and out of there. And he noted that a number of individuals returned for additional treatments of infections. And he also noted that besides the normal fish population of the area crowding in to be taken care of, there were large black sea bass and even these giant ocean sunfish you may have seen in an aquarium, or like as not, one of the oceanariums, or a book, if nowhere else. Now, another time, to find out just what effect these cleaner fish would have on the population of fish around some of these reefs, this Dr. Limbaugh decided to remove all of the cleaner fish from one station he'd been watching in the Bahamas, and the results were absolutely startling. Within just a few days after he had somehow captured and taken all these cleaner fish out, the total population around that area had dwindled down to practically nothing, and within 2 weeks, there wasn't a fish left at all. And, well, there were just a tiny few here and there. The whole area that had been teeming with fish was practically devoid, and the ones who were left were very sick. Every one of them had fungus growths, open sores, infections, ragged fins, and a complete run-down condition. Because their cleaner fish had somehow disappeared. Now, how do you figure that? How did that relationship get started? Evolution doesn't have any answer, because many of these have such a partnership that the one could not, literally could not exist without the other. Many animals and birds find their food in association with other creatures, and the partnership is never just one-sided. Sometimes it seems to be, but actually it's not. The one exists only on something that is provided by the other. I mentioned the example of this type of lichen that is up in the tundra. And there's so many examples like that, even right down to tick birds that go along the backs of rhinoceros, or some of these various types of birds that clean the backs of animals. African antelope remain in good condition by visits from a type of bird that gives them a thorough going over. And crocodiles have a similar association with tick birds, and they'll even lie there and open up their mouth. wide and let a bird walk in and out of it and pick their teeth clean. How do you figure it? Can you imagine how many millions of years it must have taken those crocodiles to get used to those birds walking around inside and out of their mouths, and how many of them must have died with that instantaneous slap of that mouth as it clamped shut on them and killed them instantly? Well, now, of course, I say that with tongue-in-cheek because that didn't happen. When you see this fantastic balance and the interdependency of how all life forms are held in check and how nothing lives or dies to itself, how every bit of the fantastic environment around you, the study of ecology, shows you, and it isn't just a matter of the adaptation of various creatures to their environment, but a matter of their special creation to make them so adaptable, to perform a special function and to comprise a part of the intricate balance and the delicate interdependency of all these life species. Every living thing holds a sort of a tremendous biotic potential to reproduce its own kind at a rate which, if it were not checked by other environmental conditions and other living things, would literally flood its environment and populate itself off the earth, killing everything else. Now you see man just about trying to do that today in the population explosion. But you can go back to some of the most microscopic organisms there are. For example, there's a single-celled little animal called a paramecium. It divides in two when it's 22 hours old, just a single little cell. Suddenly it divides in two and it becomes two cells. In another 22 hours, each of these animals will have grown to full size and they're ready to divide again and so on. Now let's just speculate about that. What would happen if a solitary paramecium began to divide on January 1st of 1967, and all of its offspring survived, by March the 7th, its descendants would have a volume of a cubic mile, a giant blob of paramecium. Imagine that. And by April 12th, their combined volume, listen to this, this is mathematic, this is scientific, would be as large as that of the whole of the Earth. From January 1st to April the 12th, one cell at its present observed rate of division could literally become as big as the land mass of the entirety of this earth. Now, obviously, no such population explosion is ever allowed in nature, among the birds, the animals, the insects, the microorganisms in the sea. And yet every species possesses a similar potential to do the same thing, to grow and to multiply fantastically. And this inherent capacity to reproduce is limited by numerous factors that have been very specially and skillfully provided. Anything from starvation to accident, drought, hazards, predators, parasites, and all of it to maintain a delicate and intricately maintained and sustained environment that is kept in such delicate balance. There is no other answer but that all of this was begun at the same time, and that all of it was created. The food chains, the food webs, the food pyramids, and all life forms. And now there are these three primary food chains, the predator chain, the parasite chain, and the saprophyte chain, which is carried on largely in the soil by these tiny microorganisms I was talking about in the last couple of programs, breaking down plant and animal matter. And those chains themselves are always interwoven into a sort of a tight-knit pattern, a food web with a bewildering number of interlaced strands. It's virtually impossible to take a single food chain from a community, since each link in the chain has living links leading back to other animals and plants. Everything is absolutely irrefutably tied in with something else. Nothing lives and dies to itself. When you examine, now when I say a food chain, I'm talking about the microorganisms in the soil that break up and cause to decay and to decompose and to be put back into useful and utilized elements and minerals in the soil, all of the living plant and animal matter that dies and becomes a part of the ground, and also break up rock and metal, and so cause it to be put into a perfectly usable form. Now, at the same time, out of all of this soil is being broken up and worked upon by these microorganisms, you have living plants with their root systems and their leaves. And they're performing a fantastic function. They're taking carbon dioxide out of the air, that is, of course, the largest amount of gas in what we call air, and producing oxygen through the process that is called photosynthesis. But they can't do this without the microorganisms in the soil that give them the nutrients that become a part of their leaves. And they can't do that without the sun shining upon them. And so it all takes a complex balance. Now man comes along and eats the plant, but the plant can't even survive without all kinds of insects, and especially the bee. The plant can't survive without a certain depth of soil, a certain type of soil, rainfall, and the sun. It can't survive without this tremendous food web in the soil, the microorganisms. So the plant can't survive without hundreds and literally thousands of species of minute microscopic life. Man and animals can't survive without the plants. The plants can't survive without man and animals. My friends, it all had to come into existence at the same moment. It all had to be set up and start at an instant. It all had to begin as a mature creation at a precise instant. It really did. And science proves this is true, absolutely and without question. And all you've got to do is to look into it. Now, we're doing precisely that. It's going to take a long time to get to every last little bit of it. How could you? Because, after all, this is a subject that is so vast and so broad you couldn't touch but a tiny part of it in the next X number of years of research and study. But currently, in the present number of the Plain Truth magazine, is an article about dolphins and about fish and how science claims that fish evolved into animals, and then certain numbers of these land animals evolved back into the mammals that swim in the sea and managed to change their whole skeletal system, their entire construction, their very tissue and flesh and skin, move their nose up between their eyes and then up to the top of their head, change their entire metabolism, change their nervous system, their digestive system, and do all of this and become dolphins and whales. Now, this article shows the whole thing is a fluke, and you can prove that by reading it, and also every single number of the Plain Truth magazine. We're going to have articles along this line that do absolutely demonstrate and prove your God exists. All you need to do to receive it is to write for it. It's free of charge. No one's going to call on you. There is no request for money. In the current number also is this article on what do you mean the unpardonable sin. People want to know, what is sin? Well, this article tells you. What's the Bible definition of it? And what do you mean the unpardonable sin? Can a Christian commit a sin and still be a Christian? Thousands worry about it. Well, here's an article that will give you understanding. And it's an encouraging article. Another one on with Wilson and Bond, the one on what colleges and universities do not tell you, and this article on the dilemma of the doubting dolphins on the subject of evolution. And also write in for this booklet on the wonderful world tomorrow, what it will be like, because here's a booklet that shows you in step-by-step form the real solutions to the biggest problems confronting mankind today. The solutions to the problems of the economy, of burgeoning, exploding populations, the problems of growing racial hatred and intrigue, the problems of political divisions, and the problems of the stockpiling of hydrogen and atomic weapons. And here is a booklet that marches right on out into the future in step-by-step sequence and detail to show you what are the solutions to these problems, the good news beyond. The title of the booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. Full color throughout. Absolutely free of charge, graphically illustrated. Here's a picture of fantastic wheat farms, all land becoming productive, the solution to the big problems that especially concern farmers today. Free of charge, no price, if you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. The address will be given again in just a moment. And so until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.